to call to order the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. It's 8:05, March 9th. Present Representative Gardner, Keller, co-chair Heron, and myself, Kathy Munoz, co-chair. Today, we have three bills up, the University Lands Bill. We have two bills, one by Representative Faircloth, House Bill 361, and a second bill by Representative Lynn, HB 336. We have the University Lands Bill, which is going to take a lot of time today. We're going to allow the Representative Faircloth to present first, and here to present is Crystal Koneman with her staff. If you have questions, we'll have an opportunity for questions, but we hope that this will be fairly straightforward and that we can act quickly on this bill. Also, let the record show that Representative John Harris has joined us. Thank you, Crystal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Crystal Koneman, staff to Representative Faircloth. My boss is here poking her head in. We do have a resolution up in State Affairs as well this morning with a staffer that's presenting a bill for the first time. So she's going to be supporting her. But what we have before us is House Bill 361, which is an act requiring 911 dispatchers to be trained in cardiopulmonary resuscitation, otherwise known as CPR. Currently, in statute, there is no provision requiring 911 dispatchers to be trained in CPR. We believe this is something that should be taking place to facilitate those that call 911 to provide support for those people while help is on the way. And ultimately, we believe that this may save some lives.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for Crystal? Yes, Representative Harris.
Crystal, thank you. I don't see any fiscal note in here. Is there a fiscal note in here?
Madam Chair, we did just receive a fiscal note from Public Safety this morning, and I don't know if you have it or not.
He's got it.
Okay.
Is there a fiscal note from any of the municipalities around the state or communities or anything? If this, Madam Chair, if I may, this bill passes, is this an unfunded mandate?
Representative Harris, through the chair, I have not received any fiscal notes from the municipalities. We are in step one of the process. I have been talking with the municipalities, trying to figure out what this may in fact do to them, and I will be able to get you those answers.
But if I may, Madam Chair, is this the strong arm of the state telling municipalities that for them to have a dispatcher, normally in the police department or maybe the fire department, but the police department, I guess, that their dispatchers have to have a certain qualification, right? And is it their responsibility as the employer to pay for or to cover the costs of these people doing this, and what becoming this qualification, and what does it do for small communities around the state who may have dispatchers, but maybe they don't get that qualification or have more difficult time getting that qualification?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, Representative Harris. Most of what I've found in talking with some of the different municipalities, Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Nome, Soldotna, even some of the smaller ones, they're already trained in emergency medical dispatch, which already encompasses CPR. And so I am trying to find everyone out there that's already trained in this, so it wouldn't be an extra cost for those that are already trained as emergency medical dispatchers. For those that aren't, there would be a cost associated with that. I've looked online. You can do a CPR training course online, and it's like $20 for that. And there's also a group discount. So ultimately, it's one of those things that we have to weigh, you know, whether a life is worth, you know, an extra $20 or thereabouts.
Representative Harris?
I'm done for now.
Are there additional questions? No. Okay. Online for questions, Tammy Gogia from the Kenai Borough. Tammy?
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity
to speak to this. I presume you all received the letter that was sent, emailed to the co-chair and the rest of the group regarding the Kenai Peninsula Borough's opinion on House Bill 361. And I would just like to add that I believe I understand the purpose and intent behind the bill, but I would propose that the execution of a CPR certification mandate does not address the root cause of the problem that exists today in Alaska, and that is the lack of mandated minimum training standards for public safety dispatchers. CPR certification does not sufficiently prepare a public safety dispatcher to provide CPR instructions over the phone. Walking a caller through a 911 call, giving CPR instructions requires an approved emergency medical, as stated earlier, EMD training program and certification program that we currently have in this dispatch center, although it is not a requirement of the state. And that program is also inclusive of a quality assurance program, which ensures compliance to protocol and a sponsoring physician. It is my professional opinion that Alaska should embrace the concept of minimum training standards and state certification for public safety dispatchers. And this would include developing legislative language for minimum training requirements for public safety dispatchers. And once passed, using those standards as a measurement of performance. And that will save lives.
Thank you, Tammy. Are there questions? Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, I'd be interested in seeing her written testimony, but I guess none of us got it.
Tammy, we do not have your written testimony, so if you could provide that to the committee again, we will make sure that all the committee members receive it.
Absolutely.
Where was the testifier from, Madam Chair?
Kenai Borough.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you, thank you for your testimony, but can you tell us about the funding to pay for the training that you do in the Kenai Borough?
The funding for the Kenai Peninsula Borough comes from the 911 surcharge collected here for our emergency medical dispatch training. Our dispatch center and dispatch centers vary throughout the state is what we would call a multidiscipline center. We dispatch for police, fire, and medical. We currently have a certified.
Nobody across the office there, so.
There's one right there,
so. Thank you. I appreciate it. We'll
I'm sorry, was that for me?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tammy. Also online, we have Michael O'Hare with the Division of Motor Vehicles.
Madam Chairman, Michael O'Hare.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions for Michael?
You're on a long line, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
Yes. For Mr. O'Hare.
Mr. O'Hare, thank you.
For the record, Madam Chairman, Michael O'Hare, Deputy Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have an opinion on the bill?
The opinion of the department is we certainly support the concept of the legislation to provide a capability for emergency dispatchers to be able to walk somebody through the process of CPR to save a life prior to the emergency technicians on the scene
given to you,
certainly is a valid cause for this legislation. There's a lot of work to be done to it. There's many agencies involved in it, and my assurance to the committee that we'll work through this to get a good piece of legislation out. So,
okay. Thank you. Question. Co-chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Crystal, to the fiscal note, is this from the troopers or from public safety? Is this for 911 dispatchers that work for the state or have a contract with municipalities? It's not a mandate for 911 dispatchers that are not interconnected with the state system.
Mr. Co-chair, My understanding, like I said, I just received this, and so I've just been looking through this a couple minutes prior to the start of the committee meeting. My understanding is that this fiscal note does affect the troopers and only those within dispatchers within the actual public safety department, not the local municipalities.
Well, I guess for clarification, Madam Chair, is that for example, there are hub communities that have contracts with the troopers after hours. So I'm assuming that this fiscal would the state would pay for those municipal 911 dispatchers. But it, from my understanding, there's no, following up on Representative Harris's question, there is no impact to people that are not connected with the statewide system. Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, just to follow up to Representative Herron's comments. Michael, in your work, not with the Department of Motor Vehicles, but with Military and Veterans Affairs, which I thought you were still there, but you know, in this day and age, you never know, right? You all deal with a lot of small communities around the state with various different activities, including recruitment for the Guard and other things of that nature. Do you see this bill as any kind of hardship to small communities around the state? I understand the larger communities that, you know, that have the 911 issue and all that kind of thing. But are there, and I don't know the answer, I'm just asking the question because it was brought up to me in my office yesterday. Are there small communities around the state located in areas that are a little less accessible that would be hurt by this, or is this something that can be accommodated?
Through the chair, Representative Harris, great question. The concept of the larger communities and the smaller rural communities and their effectiveness on 911 dispatch has a lot to do with infrastructure. As we know, the state of Alaska has minimal infrastructure capabilities in those smaller communities. The good news is that the smaller communities, they all know each other, and they can get a location of an individual out pretty quick. I think it goes back to the concept of being able to provide, to walk somebody through the concept of CPR to save a life before somebody can get to that victim and perform further life safety issues is a great concept. Will it provide hardship to them? These are the kind of things we got to work out as far as financial hardship to those communities, and that's why we got to work out these issues, sir.
Okay. Yeah, and Madam Chair, I'm all supportive of this. Mm-hmm. These ideas get thrown at us, and sir, I want to make sure that there isn't some underlying unknown consequence that.
And through the chair, Representative Harris, we all appreciate your concern about those underlying consequences, and with that, we need to work through them. So.
Okay. Additional questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. What is the will of the committee?
Madam Chair, are you going to do it?
Go ahead, Drew.
Go ahead.
Madam Co-Chair, I move that we move from committee House Bill 361 with individual recommendations and all fiscal notes attached.
Thank you. Thank you, Crystal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Hopefully you'll address some of those concerns.
Absolutely. Yeah. We will work with all the departments.
Thank you. And we'll take a brief at ease while we do the individual reports, and then we'll the first committee of referral. There was an amendment offered by Representative Wilson to remove Mike Cove and to insert another parcel in Pelican. On page 8, line 22, Mike Cove is added to the list of parcels deleted from this legislation. And then on page 9, lines 29 through 31, a portion of Pelican parcel is added back in place of Mike Cove. Continuing on page 9 and 10, we heard considerable testimony at our last meeting on the Sumdum parcel. This is a 5-acre parcel south of Juneau. We are proposing to add a covenant onto the parcel that would protect the historical character and cultural character of that land. We still propose in the bill to include it in the university lands, but to have the restricted language added to the deed.
Is that 10R, Madam Chair?
That is on page 9 and 10, the sumdum person.
So you can't use it for timber harvest or mineral development?
That's correct.
No, I'm sure. Maybe we could have different.
And we'll have.
Use it for a casino?
No. Oh. We'll have Dick Milius of DNR speak to the specific language. And then the third amendment is offered by Representative Bill Thomas of Haines, and this would delete parcels in his area at Excursion Inlet, Lynn Canal, and William Henry Bay. And those are found on page 8, lines 23, 24, and 25. And we have a representative from his office here to speak to that amendment, as well as Robert Venables with the Haynesborough. And then on the fourth part. Yes.
I'm sorry if I missed something here. Was Representative Thomas's amendment offered in committee?
No, it was offered later. And this is a new amendment, but it's in addition to the other three that we considered at our last meeting.
An amendment that this committee didn't consider is incorporated in the committee substitute?
At the request of Representative Thomas, yes, but they will speak to it.
Well, I would think that we should have the opportunity to consider his amendment before it's in our substitute.
Well, actually, it looks to me like it's not. Madam Chair, if I'm reading the CS correctly, maybe I'm not, but page 8, lines 23, 24, and 25 are in there. Excursion in at Lynn Canal and William Henry Bay are all in the CS. Notwithstanding the following landscribes document.
On page 8.
Oh, it may not be conveyed.
Yes.
Okay, it may
yes.
not be conveyed.
On page 8, okay. Those parcels are,
okay.
are identified.
Okay,
yes.
All right, okay.
And then the fourth parcel is at Tenafee Springs, found on page 8, lines 26 and 27. We add to the list of deleted parcels a 40-acre parcel around the Tenafee Harbor. And we've heard from a number of individuals in the community about the importance of having the uplands access to the harbor, and also from representatives of the Tenafee tribe over the historical nature of that land. So that amendment is included in this CS as well. Okay. Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, is that the issue that the folks from Tenafee are concerned about?
There's
or are they
two,
have different issues?
There's two different.
Different issues, okay.
Different issues, okay. Okay, all right. So, are we ready for public testimony? Yes, okay. Robert Venables from Haines to speak to the amendment offered by Representative Thomas.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Venables, and among other many community-oriented hats I wear from home where I live in Haines, I'm on the Planning Commission there, former manager. And the current manager's on the ferry today, was not able to call in or be before you today. And so he and the mayor asked if I would offer some brief comments and ask your support for this the CS that's before you today. The Haynesborough has been in an ongoing process of their final land selections and working with DNR to finalize that over the past few years. These parcels here that were just mentioned in this CS were just recently identified as possible VUU lands that could be conveyed to the borough because Haines was one of the very first areas of the state that was surveyed. Most of those the VUU lands that are available have been quite restricted in number. I would also just say that we have found the University of Alaska to be just a fantastic, outstanding developer and custodian of lands that have been conveyed to them. We support that that process and mechanism for them. They have a number of parcels in the Haynesborough that they have been land holders for, and so they have done well there. But we just ask that the municipality be given first selection for these parcels. So, again, just wanted to ask for your support on behalf of the Haynesborough, and would be available for any questions.
Okay. Are there questions? Thank you, Robert. Oh,
thank you.
Madam Chair. Robert, thanks
yes.
for coming back again. You wear a lot of hats.
Yes, sir.
The amendments that Representative Thomas had inserted in here, You're all from Haines, right?
Yes, sir. Through the chair.
You support that?
Yes.
Okay. I want to make sure you did, because otherwise I'd tell you all about it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we have John and Carolyn Martin. Mr. Martin, would you like to come up, or Carolyn?
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
I have a written document here in relationship to the Executive Order 7179. A little bit of background. We've always been part of the Angoon Territory long before the coming of any outside settlers. And I think we're one of the very few villages in Alaska that have an executive order. And we most recently found out that there is an existing deed for that parcel of land. I never thought for one moment that people who understood the legality of an executive order in relationship to the Department of Interior, that I would be here testifying on behalf of our land. This is a sovereign trust land. It also surprises me that I pretty much left it up to Senator Kukesh and Representative Bill Thomas to champion the sovereignty issue. But it's apparent that I have spoken to Bill Thomas, and I asked him, please be kind to our tribe. We are the last remnants of the Tlingit Nation, that we don't want our trust land to be put on the chopping block. And for the last 40 years, we've been given support from the Klinkenhaida Central Council in the form of resolutions and their annual meeting, as well as Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp. So this means a lot to us. The indigenous people of Southeast Alaska know the existence of the trust land. So I guess in summarizing the contents of the written document is here before you in pleading with our lawmakers to give the tribe a chance to develop our land and don't wipe us out. I thank you for listening to my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And for the record, Mr. Martin represents the village of Tenneke, the Tenneke tribe, and we're talking about the 40 acres around the harbor, just for the committee's information. Yes.
Sure. Thank you very much. Is this a presidential executive order you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. And you just described the land, and the land has been in the CS. The land has been taken off, right?
That's correct.
I'm not that familiar with the executive order, so I don't know what. But do we even have? Does anybody here know? Do we even have rights to that land if that's under a presidential executive order? Do we have any rights to deal with that land, or is that under the Indian Claims Settlement Act, or is there, or what provisions federally are are encumbered with this land, or is this land encumbered with?
According to the studies of the anthropologists and archaeologists, that they know that Tenneke is named after the copper shield that was put in the water. It was a peaceful gesture by the Angoon people, that we were one territory in Angoon. And when there was a misunderstanding, they made peace with our tribe. And so they put the copper shield in the water. And that was part of the Admiralty Island that belonged to the Tenneke tribe, as well as the whole inlet of Tenneke. However, the executive order land is actually the pivot point of our tribe. And so that little parcel of land by the boat harbor, there was a little house just above the boat harbor where the ramp is right now. That little house was the house I was born in. And my grandfather actually sold the mercantile land that Snyder, O'Toole, and Pegues have now for $160. Those people used to anchor in front of Tenneke, and it was all our Thlinkit people that lived there, relative to Angoon. And we are kind people. And my grandfather asked him, why do you anchor here? We have a piece of land here. They used to bake bread, pies, donuts, and such. So my grandpa actually sold him that land. My grandfather didn't know what to do with the money, but it was like a handshake. He really liked the retired Coast Guard officer, and his wife was a nurse. Retired nurse, and they fell in love with Tenneke. So they didn't want to leave Tenneke, and they got along really well with our people. And that was the beginning of the first white settler that came to Tenneke. I really don't blame the folks that want to settle in Tenneke. It's our tribal land is beautiful. Primarily, that's the reason why our Thlinkit people settled in Tenneke.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any comments the staff going to be able to
yes,
testify on?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
I don't think we have copies of his testimony or the document he has. If we could get those,
sure.
I'd appreciate it. I'd like
Terry,
to read
Terry, can you get copies? Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Who do I get this to?
To Terry.
Okay.
Yes. Co-Chair Herron.
Do I need to sign it?
Excuse me, Mr. Martin? There is one question, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin, just so I understand, two questions of you, sir. Is there are two parcels that are in this lands bill, and the CS takes out the harbor parcel. Do you and the tribe, do you support the removal of that harbor parcel from the bill?
Well, I was thought that that executive order land was all the remnants that our tribe had, because we occupied that whole area that they're settling now. And I've always thought that that boat harbor area, that 40 acres, was part of the whole pivot point of our ownership of that executive order land. Because as you know, that area used to be a canoe run. And so that's where our people actually traded and did their hunting and fishing. And so that's the best of my ability that I can share with you, that that right now we're just fighting for our existence.
Mr. Martin, I
the executive order land was a pivot point.
Mr. Martin, I understand that part. There is a dispute that that land is tribal land. I understand that. But, of course, the state's position on it is, and DNR is on behalf of the governor, is proposing that this be given to the university. So setting aside the presidential executive order for the moment, I guess my question is specifically, and I believe this is what you support, is that in the proposed legislation from the governor, is it would give the harbor parcel to the university. We're the co-chairs and Bill Thomas are suggesting that we remove that from the governor's bill, set it aside. So it's we're it's removed from the bill. So we're not not giving that land to the university. Do you support that?
Yes, I do.
Okay. The second question, Madam Co-Chair, to you, Mr. Martin, is there's another parcel. It's the upland parcel by Indian River. Do you have a position on that from the tribe, on that particular parcel?
You know, a lot of the land issues are actually, it's not an individual decision, but I'm just here to testify for the members of the tribe, and it has to go back to also back to a discussion. So I haven't had a chance to meet with Representative Thomas or Kukesh. I guess that's their voting district. And primarily their gesture was to actually clarify what the real issues with the proposals of the university. That's the best I can do to answer you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Okay,
Martin.
Thank you.
Okay. And Casey Hotch is here from Representative Thomas's office, and we didn't give you an opportunity earlier to speak to the changes presented by Representative Thomas. Casey, would you like to come forward and speak to those changes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Casey Schroeder Hotch, staff to Representative Thomas. I really don't have anything more to add than Robert. Robert is the expert on the issue. I would just be probably reiterating what he said. So, okay. But if there's any questions, I can definitely make an attempt.
Great. Representative Harris.
Thank you. Casey, the the question that I asked Mr. Martin earlier, but your boss, probably you, but your boss gets credit for it. Put these parcels in at the request of Mr. Martin and his people. Is that correct or not?
Through the chair, to Representative Harris, the changes on page 8 are directly related to Haynes, and they were not at the request of Mr. Martin. The change regarding to the 10-acre parcel about near the harbor, yes, that was definitely in response to public outcry.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Casey. All right. Next up, we have Mary Irwin from Juneau. And Mary, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Mary Irwin, and I live at 326 6th Street here in Juneau, Alaska. My phone number is 586-1480, and I'm here today representing myself. And since I have been in front of this committee and House Education Committee previously speaking to the Sumdum parcel, I would like to not repeat that testimony, but rather to keep my comments brief and to speak to the new CS. I would, however, like to preface my comments by two remarks. One is I would like to thank the committee members for putting so much time into this bill. It's really gratifying to see. Secondarily, I would like to pay my respects to the elder in the audience, one of them anyway, John Martin Sr. It's nice to see you today. So before I move to the CS, I would like to be very clear. I am a very strong supporter of the University of Alaska. Although I received both my undergraduate and graduate degrees outside at private institutions, I have taken many rigorous classes at UAS, many fun classes at UAS, and I have also served the university for several years as an instructor for ED 593, which is a continuing ed course. I truly wish that our university system had more financial stability and support in many ways, and I find it regrettable that our university professors, especially the adjunct ones, are woefully underpaid. Now, I would like to ask that you turn to page 10 in today's committee substitute. When I was here previously, 2.5 weeks ago, you know, the idea came up to possibly exempt the Sumdum parcel from this bill. However, because of public testimony, actually, I think maybe not public testimony, but because of contacts that certain people have made since that time, instead of exemption from the bill, what has been drafted is the committee substitute. So on page 10, Sumdum is addressed in section R. And I would like to support this committee substitute. I would like to wholeheartedly support it. But I would like to suggest two changes be made so that I can wholeheartedly support it. And those changes are as follows. In section 1, if you're really interested in protecting this parcel from development, I think section 1 needs to be written a little bit more broadly. So while it does say that the Sumdum parcel may not be open to commercial timber harvest or mineral development, I would urge you to include a little bit more language such as this, to rewrite that number 1 to read, may not be open to development including but not limited to commercial timber harvest or mineral development. That broadens it to include things like docks, things like Representative Harris alluded to just a moment ago in jest, casinos, t-shirt shops. So that's number 1. And my second preference would be for this committee to possibly add a number 4 under R to read something like, it is intended that these covenants on the parcel run with the land. Covenants are not usually prescribed by the legislature. It's great that you have taken this bull by the horns, but in order for these covenants to actually run with this small parcel of land, it needs to be stated that way. And so I respectfully request that you add a fourth section under there stating very clearly the intention that these covenants on the parcel known as Sumdum run with the land. This would strengthen the protective nature of the language of the amendment to the bill. It would apply beyond the University Lands Office to whoever they sell the parcel to. And I don't think that anybody further down the line who might buy this parcel would have any heartburn with that if they truly are supportive of preserving the culturally significant resources that are currently on the land. So I'd like to again thank you so much for taking up this small 4.9 acre parcel of land and treating it with such such grace. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you. Shall we continue? Representative Harris.
I want to ask her a couple of questions. First of all, your husband's a great singer at church, by the way.
Thank you. I'll let him know.
Second of all, if what is the reason then? Tell me a little bit about this Sumdum piece of property here. Is it? It seems to be fairly controversial in this area. What is so controversial about this piece of property? Because I don't know much about it, so I would like you to educate me a little bit. And second of all, if it's that controversial, why don't we just take it off and give the university some other piece of property in place of it? I mean, I don't know. I'm just asking you.
Through the chair, again, I won't repeat my prior testimony, but I'm thrilled to be able to tell you a little bit more about the parcel. It is it's a 5-acre parcel. Actually, it's only a 4.9-acre parcel, and it is the direct town site of the old town of Sumdum from 1879 to about 1903. So while the Tsaundan Tlingit tribe, the people known as the people of the sparkling green water, had 6 clan houses in the area across the inlet of Endicott Arm, which is now a wilderness area, while their town site was across the inlet, when gold was discovered in the area in 1879, earlier than Juneau, earlier than Nome, earlier than Fairbanks, it sprang into action. A town sprang up there. So while the area is rich in Tlingit history, there's probably old fish traps in the area. I don't know, but there may be petroglyphs in the area. There may be culturally modified trees in the area. People gather spruce roots for thousands of years there, you know, collected berries and fish and all that. But moreover, it's a layered archaeological site, so that you have the remains of the first brewery in American Alaska there. You have, as John Martin Sr. mentioned earlier, canoe runs. And it's where Samuel Hall Young, the Presbyterian missionary, pulled up his canoe with 3 Tlingit leaders and also the explorer John Muir. They pulled it right up on that beach in 1879 in a very strong gale force wind storm. So it's a layered archaeological site, and it is used by many people for recreation, and people like myself for recreational history. At first, I was interested in seeing it excised from this bill because it is so rich in cultural significance. It's on record with the Office of History and Archaeology up in Anchorage. I understand, though, that the bill, the administration, is interested in keeping the land list as intact as possible. And so that's when came forward this interesting idea of placing restrictive covenants on it. If the land is simply transferred back to DNR, we may have to fight this battle again and again and again. The files on record at the SHPO's office up in Anchorage, the State History and Archaeology office, are not public documents. They are available to you as legislators, and they are available to archaeologists. They're not available to me. So frankly, I don't know the entire nature of the site. I don't know other parcels of land that DNR could proffer up in the alternative to this one. So I guess enough work has been done, and if the work continues today on, you know, the two bits of massaging that I see that need to be done on the committee substitute, if those could possibly be incorporated, I think that might be a good way to go for this parcel. It is, as you can sort of feel, kind of a weird parcel to be in this land bill. Since it has some archaeological nature to it, it's probably never going to be, hopefully never going to be, developed. And the parcels given over to the university under this lands bill are for development purposes to raise money for the university. So I think I've given you a long-winded answer. I'm sorry about that.
Okay. No, that's fine. I don't want to belabor this too long, but Madam Chair, perhaps, I mean, the university uses land for a lot of things. They don't just have to use it for revenue. They can also use it for archaeological type work, and I assume the chancellor from one of the branches is here. I assume that the university does that kind of work in some one of their branches. Perhaps they might be interested, Brian. I don't know if you are going to testify or not, but You want to step up here for a second, Madam Chair? Could I have him step up here just to answer that question?
Sure. Madam Chair, can I respond to that before Brian comes to the desk? I'm sorry, just briefly. I have actually talked with people at the university in our university system, and I've spoken to anthropology professors and history professors. And while they're universally dismayed that a piece of this culturally significant property would be ripped out of the public domain, they don't have the graduate student labor to deal with this. Nobody besides me, frankly, has been doing research on this property. There are records at the SHPO's office that state that it is historically important and it's anthropologically important. But frankly, I have not seen any interest from the university. And you know, one point would be that we're not exactly with this bill giving the land to the university for safekeeping. We're giving it to the University Lands Office for fundraising. So I must say that there has been very little interest from the academics at the university. So, okay.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Rogers, please come forward.
For the record, I'm Brian Rogers, Chancellor, University of Alaska Fairbanks. I personally walked the Sum Dum property, so I'm well aware of the significance of that property. Clearly, the land grant in this legislation covers both educational and investment properties. If it's the will of the legislature that this be preserved for educational purposes, it will be available for archaeological research in the future. And if we understand, I mean, clearly the intent, original intent of this as passed in the earlier legislation was for commercial purposes. While there has not been funding for archaeological work to date, there certainly could be if this amendment is adopted.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Just Madam Chair, Mr. Chancellor, the university may not have funding for archaeological work at this point in time, but is it common that universities share with one another sites around the country or around the world with other universities who do that kind of work? Maybe somebody from Egypt, or maybe somebody from Africa, or maybe somebody from some other part of the world where artifacts are found, historical artifacts are found all over the place, might have an interest in that type of thing on this piece of property and would work through your university.
Through the chair, in response, yes, we do cooperate with other universities, and certainly having title to land makes it a lot easier to actually do that without having to go through a new permitting process.
Thank you. Thank you. And next, from the City of Tenneke, Art Bloom. Did you have questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, on this issue, if we could, I'd like to hear what Mr. Milius thinks about the proposal.
Okay, let's go ahead and have Mr. Okay. Bloom up, and then we'll have Mr. Milius after. Thank you.
I'll try and be very brief. Can I assume that in the committee substitute is supported, then I don't really need to speak to the two parcels by the harbor, unless you have questions for me on that?
Are there questions regarding that parcel? No. Continue.
Okay.
Thank you.
You do have a letter from our mayor that I think was delivered to every member of the committee. And I'd just like to just very quickly explain a few of the things in there, because it can be quite confusing. I don't know if you all have copies of the Memorandum of Understanding from 1977 or the stipulation, the court-ordered stipulation. I just very quickly will read to you two paragraphs that are very relevant to this other parcel in ST-103, which is referred to as C-34. In the Memorandum of Understanding, it says under conveyances, paragraph 8, it says, the state will convey to the city title to any selected lands conveyed to the state by the Bureau of Land Management, except that the state may retain title to those sites necessary for present or anticipated essential public purposes. And then in the stipulation for settlement, which is a Superior Court First Judicial District document, the state specifically excludes certain parcels of land from the conveyance. And those parcels and this is where it gets confusing, those parcels are listed under paragraph 1.1 through 1.6. Now, 1.1 actually refers to what's called C33 on the northern area southeast, northern southeast area plan from DNR 2002. So those parcels are specifically identified. C34 is actually paragraph 1.2. And all the maps, and this is a map of the area, these two parcels here are the ones that are by the harbor. This parcel here, C34, is up by the Indian River Road. They all have specific references to the paragraphs in the stipulation. I'd just like you to consider that this is a court-ordered document that has stipulations referring to these parcels of land. And while there's nothing here that may prevent, say, C34 from being turned over to the university, where it might be arguable what essential public purposes are, we believe that the university would still be bound by the restrictions in the stipulations. And therefore, we would question of what value it might be to the university. And that stipulation is that parcel C34, it says it's commercial, industrial, road right-of-way, and borrow pits, 61 acres more or less. It is understood that the state will allow the removal of reasonable amounts of material under reasonable conditions from all borrow pits for the purposes of personal use in residential improvement or construction, driveway construction, and landscaping. The land to be retained by the state for commercial, industrial, road, right-of-way, and borrow pit purposes is described as follows. So we believe that land would be encumbered by this court-ordered stipulation. That's all. I'd be happy to answer any questions, because I know it can get confusing. The land is referred to under two different sets of designations. But.
And the if you could speak to the stipulation that came about as a response or a reaction to the activity, the commercial activity that was happening there with the wasn't it Alaska Pulp or?
Alaska Pulp Corporation,
and
yes.
So it was a stipulation of agreement between the state, the city, and Alaska Pulp, is that correct?
That's correct. In the late 70s, Alaska Pulp Corporation wanted to begin logging in Indian River. Because it was within the corporate boundaries of the city of Tenneke, there was discussions between Alaska Pulp Corporation, the city of Tenneke, and the state of Alaska. And actually, the memorandum of understanding is signed by Bob Laresh, who was then the commissioner of DNR. And basically, what it was about from the city's point of view was conveyance of the municipal entitlements to the city. The city wanted the state to give it its municipal entitlements. Alaska Pulp Corporation wanted to log in Indian River, and the state wanted to see it all come to fruition. So there was a memorandum of understanding that was signed, which stated that the state would turn over land to the city. However, by 1981, no land had been turned over, so the city of Tenneke sued the state to get its municipal entitlements based on the memorandum of understanding. That went to court. The court ruling was in the city's favor. Those stipulations were court-ordered stipulations that said that the state had to turn over the municipal entitlements. The state was allowed to withdraw certain parcels of land, which are now the ones we're talking about, or two of them anyway. That stipulation was amended twice because Alaska Pulp Corporation had to extend its period of logging.
Okay.
And there's quite a bit of other history in there, but I don't know that it's really relevant to you.
And did the city of Tenneke complete its municipal entitlement?
We actually believe that it has not been completed. We believe that these two parcels by the harbor should have been turned over to the city. At the time that the state transferred or conveyed the land to the state, these two parcels were in contention because of prior native allotment claims. Those claims were adjudicated, and in 1986, the parcel directly above the harbor, known as C-31, was conveyed to the state. This was 5 years after the stipulation. We believe that, according to the memorandum of understanding and the stipulations, that the state should have at that time conveyed that parcel of land to Tenneke as part of its municipal entitlement. We believe it was probably just an oversight when the federal government conveyed it to the state that nobody in DNR remembered the memorandum of understanding or the stipulations and just put it into the state resource. Okay. In 2003, the second parcel, known as C-32, was conveyed from the federal government to the state. Same thing happened. We believe that that parcel should then have been turned over to the or conveyed to the city, but it wasn't. And we believe this is the case because these parcels are not specifically withdrawn. You'll notice on the map that I showed you that neither C-31 or C-32 has a paragraph reference. That's because neither of those two parcels were specifically identified by the state in the stipulations.
Okay. Are there questions for Mr. Bloom?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are these parcels that you're talking about, are they in the CS or not?
Only C-34, yeah.
And what was the other one you wanted?
C-35? I'm just, no, C-31 and C-32 are the two parcels by the harbor. Okay. C-34 is the one by Indian River Road. But since you already are agreeable to remove those two parcels by the harbor, I wasn't really speaking to those other than to answer your question. But I just
excuse me, we move a lot of parcels around here and there.
Right. Do you have additional questions? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bloom. Okay. I'd like to have Wendy Redman from the university come forward and speak to the university's position and also some of the public testimony that you've been hearing, if you could give us feedback on your thoughts.
Yes, Madam Chair, my name is Wendy Redman. I'm the Executive Vice President of the University System. I believe there was testimony at the last meeting from Mary Montgomery on the general overview of the bill. Did you have specific questions?
I just wanted to give you the opportunity to present the university's position and if you had any opinion on some of the parcels that we're talking about specifically today, I think that would be helpful.
Well, I have a great deal of frustration, Madam Chair, as you might guess. This is the university's had six, this is the sixth land bill that the university's had in my tenure at the university, and I've been involved with five of them. Well, I guess actually all six. And I understand that people who are opposed to the specific pieces in the land bill support the university. It's not a personal thing. I understand that. But I also understand that the legislature recognized five times that the university, as a land-grant university, was essentially owed some land. And through the process of statehood, the land that had been assigned to the university, those rights were extinguished, and the state was essentially promised that they'd take care of it over time. And that has happened. Back in the 2005 bill, we finally reached an agreement. The state recognized that at least moral responsibility, and we thought we had an agreement. Now, we disagree completely with the Supreme Court ruling on this, but nonetheless, we're back here again trying to make accommodation with that Supreme Court ruling. It was very important to us to not have to come back in brand new and start all over again selecting lands, that we'd come back in with the same list that the legislature had already approved, and frankly, we had already argued out in this kind of detail for a whole session and a half. So we're re-discussing a lot of these same issues. I understand what the concerns are. People are worried. Some of the worries are, you know, really not legitimate. Some dumb, for example, I mean, the university certainly doesn't have any intention to go out and put up a commercial property on some dumb. That would be not in our interest to do that. The university has its land management around the state. We have been responsible for some incredible activities in the state that have brought both commercial and private residential developments to communities all over the state through our land management. I think many people, you don't hear from the people who have had all of the great experiences in dealing with our land management office. It is, we try to make it easy for communities to deal with us. We have a great deal of community involvement before we go forward with any kind of project. The Board of Regents have a whole process in place where we have community hearings and so on to make sure that we're not going to be in a difficult situation with the local community. That wouldn't be in our interest to do that. Relative to the specific properties that are of concern right now in Tenneke, I thought there had been some discussion of a swap of properties, I believe, at the last meeting, although I'm not sure they were equal in acreage. My understanding, at least prior to this session, we had had a lot of discussion with Tenneke, and in fact the city was we were close to making a deal with Tenneke because they want that property, and it was easier for them to get it from the university, the harbor property, than it was going to be to get it from DNR. So had the Supreme Court not intervened, that would have gone through. That particular arrangement would have been culminated. The other properties, I'm not sure what other amendments you have in this bill. Was there something in HUNA?
No, there were amendments from Haines at Excursion Inlet, William Henry Bay, and a parcel at Lynn Canal.
I'm not familiar, Madam Chair, with those particular properties, but Mary Montgomery is on the line if you have some specific questions about those.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Redman? Yes.
Thank you, Wendy. When you choose to develop any given piece of land, do you take into account the concerns and the interests of fellow Alaskans who have either a long heritage interest or more recent interest in that property? I mean, do you, as a land office, a good experience that folks have, you know, what's the process? I mean, you certainly take into account, I would think, and I just wondered if there's anything that you would want to describe on it.
Well, Madam Chair, again, the university, first of all, let me make clear, the university didn't select these lands. DNR basically selected the lands that would be given to the university. If we, you know, had an opportunity to go in and decide which of the state lands we would take for our 250,000 acres, these may or may not have been the specific lands. So, that said, the lands that are that DNR has available for transfer are lands that have already been designated as available for transfer. They've gone through whatever process DNR goes through to determine that they are in fact available for transfer, for development, for sale, for other types of activities. So they don't have restrictions on them.
Yeah, maybe I wasn't clear, but I was thinking of some dumb, but my question is more general. The reason I was just thinking about if it was restricted to all development, the consequences of that, you know, that broad term, like if you wanted to go in and put in a moorage for boats that come in the recreation, that may come up in question. But my question is, how do you take it, I'm not, in general, if you're going to develop a piece of property, surely, I mean, the interests of the university are foremost, but the people live in a community, the people that have interest in use of the lands adjacent or whatever, that's all taken into account. It's a very softball question. I was just wanting to basically address.
Madam Chair, that you're correct. I mean, it certainly is not in the university's interest to make everybody mad in a community, and I'm not aware that we've done that.
Okay, thank you. Co-Chair Herron has a question.
Good morning, Wendy. Good morning. Two questions. First question, does the university support the CS as drafted?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I haven't really had an opportunity to review it in detail, so I can't answer that question.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, second question. Wendy, would the university be amenable to crafting some sort of conduit legislation where the university, if they got the harbor land by Tanaki, that again, there would be conduit legislation or conduit language that you could it eventually end up in their hands?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I'm not sure. End up in whose hands?
Tanaki's, the city of Tanaki. You referred to that you were in negotiations at a prior date. That would have happened had not the Supreme Court got involved.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I think so, but I'd like to check that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the only issue with that is, I mean, legitimately, the university would be in the position of a property owner trying to sell their property if that's what they desired to do, and to say in legislation that they could only sell it to the city of Tanaki, that pretty much says, okay, well, then we can only sell it to them for whatever they want to buy it from. So, I mean, so I don't think you really want to have it where you bind the hands of somebody trying to sell the property, saying, you know, you can't talk to anybody else. I mean, it doesn't sound to me like it's their intention to do that, but yet if DNR owns the property, I can guarantee you if they're going to sell it to somebody, they're going to want to go out on the open market and sell it to the highest bidder, right? And mm-hmm. maybe they won't, but at least it doesn't bind their hands to say that's the only people they can talk to. So. And you have to be a little bit careful there.
Madam Co-Chair, to that, yes. Representative Herron says, a conduit vehicle. I mean, obviously, it'd be just that. It wouldn't be a guarantee.
Okay. Thank you. We have four people online that would like to testify, and we're running out of time, so I'd like to turn to the individuals online. Mr. Michael Fay, thank you very much, Ms. Redman, for your testimony. Michael Fay from Mosier Bay.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Could
yeah,
you
my
please?
My name is Mike Fay.
Yes.
My phone number is 254-1902. I'm a resident of Mosier Bay, just north of Ketchikan. And I braved the wind in my boat to come talk to you today. I'm glad I'm here. Mosier Bay, if you kind of take your boat around Ketchikan, it's not very far from Ketchikan, and it's probably one of the most pristine valleys in the whole area. It's a beautiful place. That's why I live there. Every morning you wake up to this beautiful place. And that's the reason why thousands, if not tens of thousands of people come to visit that valley every summer. And it gets a little bit bothersome because there are thousands of boats that come through there every year, but the reason they come there is to see this beautiful place that's within a stone's throw of Ketchikan. So this Mosier Bay parcel that's in this bill is at the heart of this pristine valley. And I've been around logging for about the last 30 years. And to my mind, and I don't know what the future really lies for this piece of property as far as what the plans are, but in my mind, clear-cutting this parcel would be an enormous blunder. It's very steep. The timber value is low. Trees are pretty small, and it's a lot of hemlock and not too much spruce and bunch of small cedar in there, so to my mind, it's really not worth much. And I think that, you know, the highest and best use of this property is to maintain its pristine quality. I really believe that the long-term economics of Moser Bay lie in its position, its proximity to Ketchikan, and its pristine kind of landscape. So I think, you know, what I'm asking is that people consider that in this bill. And I think that, you know, I would certainly support some kind of slow, selective logging of that parcel over a long time by local guys who have small mills and who would make secondary products out of that wood and meter it out over a long period of time. But clear cutting, I think, is absolutely not an option there. And I also believe that permanent protection, just for its pristine nature, would be the highest and best use for that land. So that's what I wanted to say to you today, and hopefully I'll be able to brave the wind back to Moser Bay.
Well, thank you for your testimony. We appreciate hearing from you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And from Marengo, we have Stephen Paisanka?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Stephen Paisanka, and I represent AICS, the Alaska Crossings Program. The Alaska Crossings Program is the state's largest therapeutic wilderness program, and we also provide experiential science programs for Alaska Native youth from the communities of Wrangell, Heidelberg, Craig, Klawock, Metlakatla, and Southeast Island School District. I took a look at where each of the representatives from this committee were from, and I can honestly assure you that we've had kids from every one of your communities. The kids come down for a 49-day wilderness expedition based out of our floating facility at Deer Island. Each year, the program has over 250 youth that attend the programs based at this facility. From this base of operations, we set out on canoe expeditions to take us along the Cleveland Peninsula shoreline, with about 60% of our programs utilizing the area currently in question, which for us is Sunny Bay. Our program has never testified regarding a timber sale that has been proposed by the Forest Service or the state. The reason that we are speaking out against this sale is that it will have such a dramatic effect, both from a visual standpoint, but also from a disruption, from the disruptions that will take place from the general activities that are associated with this type of industry. I want this committee to understand that our most important resource is the land that we are privileged to work on and around. And if we remove this tripping area, we will dramatically decrease our capacity for programs. We have options, but options in my business translates to more dollars. If I have to transport groups to other areas of the forest, it will have a dramatic impact on the finances of the program. We may actually be forced to move our entire marine research station from this area. This would cost the agency in excess of $40,000 and would disrupt our services for an extended period of time. AICS Alaska Crossing now employs 85 full and part-time people, or the equivalent of 45 FTEs in Wrangell. Our agency is by far the largest employer in Wrangell, and we have a sustainable model that is based on controlled growth, funding diversification, and program development. I respectfully request that the area in and around Sunny Bay be removed from the block of sales proposed for cuts. Please help us to ensure that we are able to provide services for Alaska youth today and into the future. I thank you for your time today and for the committee's hard work in this area.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you. And next we have Tim Linden. Tim? Hello, Mr. Linden.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. Please state your name and affiliation.
Hi, my name is Tim Leiden. I'm from Juneau. I'm speaking with my wife as a Juneau resident, but also I'm here to talk for 17 commercial tour operators that operate in Southeast Alaska. I won't list all of them, but it includes the American Safari Cruises, Alaska Sea Adventures, Pacific Catalyst, Alaskan Song, Alaska on the Home Shore, and many others. This group represents thousands of visitors to Southeast Alaska, and they represent a very important part of Southeast Alaska's tourism industry. because they are small and mid-sized tour operators, many of their clients spend more time in our communities, like Juneau and Wrangell and other communities, than the larger number of cruise ship passengers. They come for lodging and and spend money in restaurants and just in general spend more time in towns. And these small companies provision locally. So this is a very unique and important sector of the tourism industry. The 17 companies have asked me to speak about the Sumdum parcel in the University Lands Bill, and I've testified at other hearings, and so I'll be brief today, and I'll try not to repeat my earlier testimony. However, I'm sorry, I don't know the name, but one of the representatives asked Mary Irvin earlier why Sumdum is so controversial, and I would like to add a little bit to that. Mary has very eloquently and passionately talked about Sumdum's cultural values at every hearing, and I think that has resonated with lawmakers. And I appreciate that testimony, and I feel that on the cultural values alone, Sumdum should be not considered for transfer to the university and not considered for development. I'll get to possible solutions in a moment. But in addition to the cultural values, there is a lot of controversy surrounding the Sumdum parcel because of its current uses. And those current uses are people like my wife and I who live in Juneau and who appreciate Sanford Cove and Endicott Arm, where this Sumdum parcel is located. But it's also important to these commercial tour operators, which is why they've asked me to speak to you today. The Sumdum parcel is directly in the middle of the Tracy Arm Ford's Terror and Chuck River Wilderness areas on the Tongass National Forest. It's squarely in the middle of about 730,000 acres of federally designated wilderness. And of course, the Wilderness Act dictates that these lands be managed for values like solitude, for wildlife, and for their undeveloped nature. And so I know that the Wilderness Act doesn't apply to state lands. However, what makes the Sumdum parcel so controversial is the threat of development on this five-acre state-owned parcel in the middle of this huge and very popular wilderness area. If you go to the websites of any of the 17 companies that I'm speaking for today, you will see that the reason that their thousands of clients come to Southeast Alaska every year is because these operators promise to take them to undeveloped places. And Sanford Cove in Endicott Arm is one of, if not the highlight of many of these trips for people. It's an area that has salmon streams, it has bears, wolves, an incredible variety of wildlife, and bird life. Also, if you know Tracy Arm and Endicott Arm at all, and Ford's Terror, you know that these are very steep places where you don't have very many opportunities to hike or to go ashore, or stretch your legs, or to see cultural ruins. And so many of the tour operators, in fact, I'd say most of them, have permits with the U.S. Forest Service to take people ashore in the Sanford Cove area to experience that wildness. And that is a very unique opportunity in that area because of the steepness of the land. But you have
Mr. Leiden, excuse me, we're coming to the end of the hour here. We have one more bill that we need to take up. Could you please summarize? We are working on an amendment for Sumdum.
Okay, I understand, and I will summarize. I just want to impress upon you that the undeveloped nature of that place is very unique along Stevens Passage, and many of our operators have operated in Southeast Alaska for 30 years and know that these opportunities are growing more rare. That's why it's so controversial, and also for people like us in Juneau who don't represent thousands of visitors but who are vested in these lands, they're very important to us. I would just like to, in conclusion, refer to what Mary Irvin said rather than repeat it. But basically, if you're going to put a covenant on this piece of land, please do it the right way. To be honest with you, mining and logging are not really the prime threats here. The prime threat, although a casino isn't likely, it's development. It's a dock, it's flight seeing, it's day tours to the glaciers. Putting a development there is going to affect thousands and thousands of people, and these companies in particular. But I also speak to the one representative who said, why don't we just remove it from the bill? And I really think, and this group of operators really thinks, that the best thing is to do, put a covenant on this so that we never have to fight this battle again. And also, why transfer it? How is the university going to make money on it if you have a restrictive covenant? Please make that covenant please make that covenant apply to development so no one can put a lodge or a private home or a dock there. I understand
Could you please summarize? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you very much for for your testimony. I appreciate it. And we are going to work on the amendment, and we will consider the additional language offered by Ms. Irwin. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, was yes. The gentleman calling from Juneau?
Yes.
He had a little hard time walking 400 feet up to the Capitol, I guess, huh?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Leiden. And next we have Mark Galla from Wrangell.
Hi. My name is Mark Galla. I'm owner-operator of Alaska Peak and Zizias and a constituent of Biggie Wilson's. I would just like to state I've been operating in a hunting, sightseeing, cruising, wildlife viewing, and fishing business in this area for over 20 years. I conduct all of these activities in the Sunny Bay area, including Santa Ana to the north, as well as Emerald Bay, Vixen Inlet on the south end. My mainstay is really brown bear hunting, which I'm allocated 7 brown bear hunters a year. These bears travel between these areas of Vixen Inlet, Emerald Bay, Santa Ana, with Sunny Bay lying right in the middle of all of that, as well as the fish streams and estuaries that these bears live in. If these places were to be logged or altered by logging or road system, would it severely impact my ability to operate here? This conveyance of land has the potential of completely removing me from this area, certainly for a number of years, while any kind of activities were going on. Not to mention these activities would forever alter the wild and scenic aspects of this area, which is also what my services are all about. On another note, I feel a very important one. This is a vital area for my brown bear hunting activities. I hunt about a 50-mile stretch of mainland coastline, which would be Unit 1B. Of this entire area, guide outfitter area, only 8 brown bears can be taken per year, expecting us to harvest, the Department of Fish and Game expecting us to harvest around 50%. If we were to harvest all 8 of these, it would drop us down to 50 or 60 as an example of how fragile this area is, which this also can be verified with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The Sunny Bay area is the southern portion of my area and often where I have to go early in the season to conduct the hunts due to just the type of geography to the north that the bears just don't tend to be emerging on the northern end of my area, so I have to go into the Sunny Bay area to actually successfully operate. The bottom line of the Sunny Bay selection, if logged or developed, is it would severely impact my operations short-term as well as long-term, since likely there would be roads put in and bears would be displaced, or even in helicopter logging scenario would severely affect it. There's actually much more higher mortality rate during these type of activities as well, which has been proven historically whenever the workers are in these areas as far as shooting game and so forth. The mainland coast and its tributaries hold relatively low numbers of bears and can very easily be over-harvested, and certainly if logged will adversely affect this already limited habitat. On the mainland, bears are mostly found in limited pockets along the coast, which makes it more challenging to be successful since the areas in between tend to be poor bear habitat. If I cannot continue to utilize the Sunny Bay area as in the past, I'm afraid this may be the end of yet another business in Southeast, namely mine. I would like to state for the record that I am not opposed to logging and certainly support it in most cases, but I know without reservation if this area is logged and developed, my business as well as the brown and black bear populations and habitats will suffer greatly, as well as people being able to see this area in the condition in which it is now, which is untouched. On a percentage basis, I would estimate this would adversely affect approximately 30% of my spring brown bear activities, and this number could be considerably higher. I basically have 4 key locations that make my bear hunting viable. Sunny Bay is one of these, and one of the problems with not being able to utilize Sunny Bay is as my season moves along, my hunters harvest their bears, I try to spread out this harvest so as not to over-harvest any one area. with Sunny Bay out of this, I would be forced to scale back my brown bear harvest or risk over-harvesting the remaining areas that that tend to produce the bears from year to year for us.
Thank you. Mr. Gallo, could you please summarize? Thank you.
Okay. In these economic difficult times, bookings are down approximately 50%. I do not think my business will survive another pitfall such as this issue. A few of these areas are of vital importance to many of us and much more valuable left as they are. There's a small limited amount of prime habitat, particularly for brown bear on the mainland. Sunny Bay is certainly one of these limited resources, limited brown bear habitat areas. More access and development, such as roads into remote areas, equals less game and viable habitat. If this selection is conveyed, it will surely be a negative impact on my business and to the community of Wrangell. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think we've allowed everybody that has signed up the opportunity to testify, so I'm going to close public testimony now and invite Mr. Dick Milius from DNR up to the table for questions. Thank you.
What'd you get in this can of worms for anyway?
Madam Chair, I guess if that's the first question, I actually will address that. because I think to follow up a little bit on Ms. Redmond's comments and also your comments, Representative Harris, from earlier. The legislature has passed seven bills since 1993, or has considered seven bills, but passed four bills since 1993 to give the university land. And all those bills, the legislature wanted us to meet a target of 250,000 to 500,000 acres. Four of those bills, like I say, passed. Three were vetoed. One of the vetoes was overridden. And that bill became Senate Bill 7, which was then followed up on by House Bill 130. So the legislature is kind of the one that set the target of trying to find 250,000 acres. It's not something that DNR or the university dreamed up. And so every time we remove parcels from the list, we get farther from that goal that was actually set by the legislature, not by DNR or the university. So anyhow, that's just a little bit of history. In terms of a lot of the issues you've heard, all the parcels that you have before you are exactly the parcels of land that the legislature approved in 2005. They were thoroughly researched before that to deal with title issues. A lot of the issues you hear today are issues that were raised previously and considered, and I'll quickly try to address some of those. And since 2005, we've actually done the work to issue deeds, and we've done extensive title research. And so some of these issues that you're hearing now are things that have been thoroughly researched by DNR. I'd be happy to provide the committee with more information on those. I will briefly address a couple of those, though, if the committee would like me to. Before you get into questions, should I address a few of those?
Why don't we turn it over to questions, because we're coming to the end of the time. Are there specific questions on the work that we've done so far? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Nick. When we when the state transfers land, DNR transfers land, whether it's a private or another government agency or University of Alaska, I mean, this happened in the past. Is it normal typically to have or occasionally to have things like covenants? I mean, is a covenant stipulation generally put on, or does that happen? I just don't know. It's an ignorant question.
Representative Carter, through the chair, it depends on the statute under which we're operating and the type of disposal. So, for example, in the Tenekee parcels where the city is interested in getting those parcels from the state, we would have a covenant on those because they would be transferred under what's referred to as public and charitable uses. So there would be a covenant, and that's what they've actually applied for those under. So they would have a title that says they can only use it for public and, well, basically public uses. And if they didn't do that, it would revert back to the state. So they couldn't sell it, and that was one of the reasons why, having to go to the university, the university could sell it without those restrictive covenants on that specific parcel. On all parcels that we transfer to private individuals, we retain the mineral rights. That's a provision of the Statehood Act where we have to retain the mineral rights. In this case, we can transfer the university mineral rights because they're actually an entity of the state. So it kind of depends on the nature of the sale we're doing and who we're giving the property to.
Questions? Yes.
Dick. The young lady in the back named Mary that came up here made some points about archaeological artifacts and all that kind of stuff in the on the Sumdum property, right? On that piece of property.
Is that something that you all have thought about as well, the historical effects of that, or is that just kind of set aside, or what's the issue there?
Representative Harris, the chair, we're aware of those resources. Under state law, those resources are, especially the archaeological resources, are protected under the State Historic Preservation Act, so that any activity on that property in terms of development has to follow those laws. Uh-huh. And that's specifically on the covenant that's proposed there. That's actually similar to the Sea Alaska actually owns adjacent lands. Or maybe, I don't know if they own them yet, but they have selections there for historical and cultural properties. And the proposed covenant is actually similar to what this is on the Sea Alaska lands.
Okay, Madam Chair, if I could just follow up one more thing, just to get on the record, because you know, I've been around here 12 years, but my friend Representative Heron over here is just on his second year. But you know, he's a pretty smart guy, and he pointed out to me that under section 6 there, subparagraph C, it says before the Board of Regents offers a parcel of land under this section, they shall offer first refusal to the closest municipality. I assume that before the university would offer that some dumb piece of property to anybody, they would have to offer it up to the city and borough of Juneau. Is that correct?
Representative Harris, to the chair, if that's actually in the city and borough of Juneau, I'm not sure if
I don't know.
The parcel
I don't know.
Is, but that
is it in or out, or do you know?
I don't think so.
Okay. Okay, so then you have to offer it up to the legislature since we're the governing body. Oh, no, never mind. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Miley, the Mike Cove Pelican Amendment, does the department support that?
Representative Heron, that is the amendment that was agreed to in the Education Committee, and so that amendment does clarify what they intended, so we're okay with that.
Okay, and then moving to the next one, the Some Dumb Covenants. So what is the position of DNR on that, again?
We worked with the sponsor on that amendment and the language. On all parcels, I mean, the governor's desire was to minimize the number of parcels being taken out, so I guess in terms of supporting removals, it's the we feel it's your prerogative to decide what ones to take out. So I'd hesitate to say we support removing any parcels, but like I say, we've worked with the sponsor and staff to follow up on the wishes of the committee and make sure that the amendments do what they desire to do.
Mr. Miles, Madam Co-Chair, another question, two more questions. Request by Representative Bill Thomas in the Haynesboro, what is the position of DNR on those?
Representative Heron, through the chair, on those, at the request of Representative Thomas, and this is kind of in response to there's a bill that would change the municipal entitlement for the city and borough of Wrangell. And in response to that bill, Representative Thomas asked us to enter into a discussion with Haynes to see if they, if there was any additional lands that were appropriate to transfer to the Haynes borough under their municipal entitlement, which they don't have a municipal entitlement, so it would have to require legislation. So we entered into discussions with the borough. And the only parcels of land that the borough could acquire through an additional municipal entitlement were the same lands that were going to the university. So we went so far only to reach an agreement that those parcels were the only parcels that the borough really could get if they were to increase the entitlement. But we didn't endorse giving them to the borough as opposed to the university, because that's basically kind of what the issue is. Should they go to the university or should they go to the borough is kind of the issue that is being raised. And we didn't want to weigh in on one in favor of the other. The governor's bill included those because the university, I guess we'd say, was first in line for those.
Thank you. And the final question, Madam Co-Chair, is of course the big question is the Tenneke Springs parcel. There's two parcels, but this CS only removes the harbor parcel. So follow up to what Representative Harris said is then in section 6 line 27 to 29 that is probably the most appropriate vehicle for a potential conveyance to Tenneke proper, in your opinion? I mean, that makes the most sense.
That would be an option, Representative Herron. That would be an option if for the city of Tenerife to approach the university about purchasing, or I know in the past they've talked about exchange or something for those.
Well, actually, the board has to offer it to the city. That's the way the language reads. It isn't the other way around.
I guess, what is the question?
Do you think that's the? Well, I suggested earlier in the meeting that there be a conveyance vehicle or some sort of way that Tenneke could have a chance at this. This seems the most appropriate.
You're the DNR expert, so.
Yeah,
I believe that is certainly one way that it could be done. I mean, there is a provision in here that the university could transfer it to the university or to the city, and they would have first rights if the university chose to sell it. And the university has in the past talked to the city about getting this parcel to them, so I think they would follow up on that. But that's kind of the Board of Regents would be the ones that would have to, and the university would have to.
Mr. Milius, what is DNR's position on the CS that removes the harbor parcel?
Representative Herron, again, like I said, I don't want to get in a position of saying I support or oppose specific parcels taken in or out. That's the prerogative of the committees to make those decisions.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Milius. Okay, I want to bring the CS back before us for discussion. What is the will of the
do
body?
Do you have an amendment, Madam Chair?
We have the CS before us.
Yeah, but do you have an amendment to that?
To add
on that sumdum property?
The sumdum, we could do.
I thought I heard you say you had an amendment you were working on.
Well, I asked my co-chair if we were going to put in amendment language based on the testimony that we heard.
Right.
And are you?
Do you have some?
Well,
thought of. I mean, this is your territory, Madam Chair. I mean, you're the expert on the sumdum property.
Well, the suggestion was under sumdum on page 10. If we can all.
Yeah.
Get to that spot in the bill to add language that would include it would state then one may not be open to development including but not limited to commercial timber harvest or mineral development. That was the suggested
You just made that amendment?
I moved the amendment.
That's very good. I like that.
Okay.
Object.
Oh, there's an objection.
Okay.
Well, for discussion, I think that that may be a little far-reaching. I can see circumstances where my fellow Alaskans who have had a long heritage there might appreciate some development in that setting, and I just think that it's too broad. And I would rather keep that to the process of what happens when the university plans to develop in a particular area that they interact. We expect them to interact. I would put that on the record that we would expect that the university would interact with the people that have an interest in that area, my fellow Alaskans that go way back before my heritage, and respect that. And so I think to restrict it from development can have implications that go farther than we want to go. I mean, we can preserve it to the point that we can't access it and use it at all. And I just am uncomfortable with that amendment.
Madam Co-Chair,
yes.
There's two potential amendments in that section, but to the first one, I understand the concerns, but there's two more committees, at least on this side of the building, that it has to go through. And my fear is if we, following up what Representative Keller said, my fear is if we amend it too restrictively, is that the entire covenant section may be stripped out in a later committee. So I would prefer that it not be even more restrictive at this time.
Okay, I withdraw my amendment on that section one.
Do you want to try the other one?
And for the record, then, I will present the second amendment, which is to add number 4 to section R with the language it is intended that these covenants run with the land. Objection. No objection. Okay, the amendment is included. Are there additional amendments? Additional discussion on the bill? Questions?
Madam Chair, are you going to move it?
Madam Co-Chair, I move that CS for House Bill 295 CNRA work draft 2829/P as amended, move from committee with individual recommendations and any attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, it is ordered. Thank you. I think we should just move right into the next and get it on the table. Okay, we'll take a brief at ease and then we'll bring the next bill up for introduction only. Thank you. We're called back to order, Community and Regional Affairs, 5 minutes to 10, and we want to get on the record HB 336 for introduction. Nancy Manley with Representative Lynn's office is here to introduce the bill. Thank you.
Hello, for the record, my name is Nancy Manley. I'm staff to Representative Bob Lynn. HB 336 puts in statute the ability for telephone or electric cooperatives to allow members to vote by electronic transmission as specified by the co-op bylaws. This bill was filed at the urging of co-ops around the state. Currently, co-op members may only vote in person or by post office. This method is outdated and could be having a negative impact on members' participation in elections and other important matters. Passing this legislation would permit electronic transmission, but only if approved by each co-op bylaws. Cooperatives choose whether they want to partake or not. This bill does not make electronic transmissions voting mandatory, and the Matanuska Telephone Association members have already voted to adopt a bylaw allowing electronic transmission voting. All they and other co-ops need is for the legislature to amend the statute to allow these co-ops to do so.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair, does this allow voting from the grave or anything like that? different forms of voting, you know? No, never.
Okay, Phil Steiner, did you want to add anything?
Just briefly, I would say for the record, my name is Phil Steyer. I am the Director of Government Relations and Corporate Communications for Chugach Electric. Chugach is supportive of this bill. Your packet contains letters of support from a number of other cooperatives that are supportive of the bill. One that I know supports it but doesn't have a letter in here is also Matanuska Electric Association. So the bill's discretionary. I can tell you lots of things about how we currently conduct elections. I can't necessarily answer every question forecasting how we might do it in the future because we haven't, it would be presumptuous to figure that we know all the answers until state statute was changed, and then we can move to interview contractors and figure out a way. I will just note that Chugach, and in my opinion, no other cooperative should engage in electronic voting unless they're comfortable they can do it in a secure fashion, and that's always our driver in our current elections. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions? Yes.
I don't see there is a fiscal note. Who would carry the burden? What department would carry the burden of the security of the voting? I mean, the cost of the software and the making sure that we only vote once and nobody votes from the grave, like.
Currently, that's an obligation that falls upon the cooperative, not upon the state of Alaska.
Okay.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
I would presume that means that the liability would be yours too.
Yeah. Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony and the introduction of the bill.
Does AELNP support this bill?
AELNP is a for-profit investor-owned.
That's family. True, yeah, they're not a cooperative.
So they're not a cooperative.
What about out in your area? Do they support it, or do you know?
It's privately held where I live.
Both of them?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is very controversial myself, so.
It may become controversial in the next committee.
With the chairman, or?
State of Harris, yeah.
You want to move it to them and let them deal with it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 336 to the next committee referral with individual recommendations and any attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, House Bill 336 passes from the CNRA committee with individual recommendations. Thank you for your testimony and introduction. Is there anything else to come before the committee today?
You made it 5 minutes, sir.
We are adjourned. Thank you.